Good morning and welcome to Mound Money on this beautiful May day. My name is Doug Wells. Larry Warren is on vacation today, and I'm grateful to have Sarah Barnes as my co-host this morning. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Doug.
So it looks like it's going to start. We had a rainy weekend, but it looks like it's going to start getting a little sunnier out there. So hopefully folks have a little bit of time to sneak away from work and get some time on the trails, because we certainly were not able to do much of that this past weekend, but hopefully this week coming forward. So we've got three great guests for you for this morning's show. Sarah, why don't you go ahead and tell us about the first two guests?
Thanks, Doug. I'm really looking forward to meeting this this group of guests. The first group are Christopher Greenwood and Lauren Forsyth from Christopher Greenwood and Associates Law Firm, based both here and in Ogden. Our second guest is Fernando and Dana Ramirez, who own Luna Lobos Dog Sledding and Rancho Luna Lobos Dog Boarding Business.
So we have a little bit of legal, we have a little bit of dog sledding, and then our final guest is going to be a Harvard professor who's written a book. She's an expert on gender equality, Iris Bonet, and she's going to argue, rather than focusing on people to try to eliminate gender bias, we should look at the systems that cause gender bias and try to eliminate those. And both Sarah and I have read the book over the weekend, and she's got some great advice. It's an important topic, and I'm looking forward to that discussion. You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW. Please stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Since 1983, we've been trying to say something clever in support of our favorite radio station. This is Jeff from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch, complimenting KPCW for making interesting radio under strict regulations. We try to do the same given our short growing season, various microclimates, and soils. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Hello, I'm Richard Bizarro.
And I'm Rick Redford with All Resort Group, a proud sponsor of KPCW.
We take pride in over 45 years of service to our community. We are committed to safe, reliable, and comfortable travel for our guests.
Reservations available at allresort.com or at 649-3999.
We move people.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. In studio with us now, we have Lauren Forsyth. She is an attorney who has recently opened up an office here in Park City. She is at the law firm of Christopher Greenwood & Associates. And we also have the man whose name is on the door, Christopher Greenwood, with us in studio. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So, Lauren, you decided to open an office in Park City. I know Christopher Greenwood is primarily headquartered in the Ogden area. Yeah. What made Park City an attractive place and that you wanted to open business here?
Well, I've been in Park City for the last 12, 13 years. So I was living here. I did move away to go to law school for a little bit, but I went to law school in San Diego, but I knew as soon as I was done, I was coming back to Park City. I love it here. I feel like it's my hometown.
Did you grow up here?
I grew up in Sandy, but I came up here when I was working on my undergrad, and I just stayed here and wanted to stay here for the rest of my life. So when I started practicing and wanted to get started, I was started speaking with Chris Greenwood, and we discussed opening up an office here, and he thought it would be a great idea, and so that's what we did.
So, Chris, let's go to you, and I'll come back to Lauren. Tell us about the areas of practice that your firm specializes in.
Yeah, I've been practicing law since 1999. And we go statewide representation, but we have an office in Ogden, we have an office in Park City, and we're going to be expanding Salt Lake, St. George as well. Primarily, areas of focus that we do are divorce, high net worth divorce, which may be of interest to your clients or your listeners here on Mountain Money.
Hopefully there's nobody out there.
Yeah, hopefully not.
But history tells us that's probably not the case.
Yeah, based on national statistics, 52% of your listeners may need some assistance in that area going forward. We also do criminal defense, white collar, as well as alcohol offenses, drug offenses. We do,
again, another area that hopefully the stats are quite a bit lower on those.
Yeah, it is. And then we also do real estate and complex civil litigation. A lot of people need things with their businesses, contracts, litigation, et cetera. We handle a lot of those types of cases and issues.
Lauren, I know you were recently involved in an important case here in Utah in the real estate sector. Can you tell us a little bit about?
Yeah. So last year, I got a pretty important ruling here out of Summit County. It was a real estate foreclosure case back during the foreclosure crisis. A home was foreclosed on here in Park City. The year was about 2007. Well, last year we got that foreclosure sale. It was ruled void. And the reason it was void is because the bank who foreclosed on it, Bank of America, had its own subsidiary, Recon Trust, foreclose on the property. In Utah, it is a bank does not have the power to sell a property. So that sale was actually void, and it was ruled on that it was as if it never happened. So the property owner who owned the home prior to the foreclosure sale still owns it. And potentially that could mean that any home that Recon Trust foreclosed on, that sale is potentially void as well.
Has this been commonplace? I mean, are there many jurisdictions where the big banks are losing out and saying, hey, that's a big, big deal that if a foreclosure is void? I mean, there's all kinds of headaches on both sides, and there's money to be made on one side and lost on the other. You're taking on the big banks. Is this happening throughout the country on a regular basis where the little guy is winning?
Not that I've seen. The only other case that I've seen like this was actually out of St. George. The judge had the same ruling. And so I've seen just a few cases in Utah where the homeowner is winning. That case out of St. George is currently on appeals. It's with and the Utah Court of Appeals actually passed on ruling on it, and it went up to the Utah Supreme Court. So the Utah Supreme Court's actually reviewing the district court's decision. But it's well-founded in Utah law that they don't have the power of sale. And so I don't see it being overturned. I can't promise anything, but.
And what was it special about this case that made it where the case was, where the foreclosure was made void, where so many others throughout the country have said, the judges have said, no, it's going to stay the way it is?
Well, every case always depends on the facts, on what's happening. In this case, it was interesting because the homeowner stayed in the home. He didn't leave. And where so many people, as soon as their homes were foreclosed on, they left and they moved somewhere else. But
so is this particular to Utah? And are you recommending that if somebody should find themselves in a situation where they're facing foreclosure, they should stay in their home?
Well, this would be particular to Utah because it is a Utah law that this ruling was based on. I am recommending that if somebody felt that if they wanted to go back and revisit what rights they have, if they lost a home, that potentially we could answer some questions for them.
And this is a public case. And to be clear, your recommendation is somebody talks to an attorney. We're not,
yes.
The idea of the show is not to give legal advice, but really to let people know what some issues are. This was a big bank I mentioned. It's a public case. The data's out there. I believe you said in the green room it's Bank of America. So if somebody had a foreclosure during the financial crisis that was led by Bank of America, in your opinion, is it worthwhile for those folks to visit with an attorney to see if there's something that can be done?
Absolutely.
Okay. And if they wanted to contact you here locally, how would they do that?
They could call me at 435-655-3680.
Okay.
They could also just pop into the Gateway Center, which is right off of Main Street. I have our offices there.
So. Okay, great. And let's switch gears. First, congratulations. That's a big win for somebody relatively shortly after law school. So that's really exciting. I'm sure that's what you and your classmates were all hoping to be able to do shortly after graduation. So congratulations on that. Chris, you were mentioning in the green room about helping high net worth families that unfortunately are going through divorce. What are some things that folks should know if they're facing that situation?
It's a It's an excellent question. We see a lot of individuals going through that. And as I mentioned, national statistics continue to grow in that area, unfortunately. We like, of course, to see, you know, husbands and wives, families remain together.
Is it lower here in Utah? Is it 50%+ here in Utah as well?
You know, it is still over the 50% mark here in the state of Utah even. So we're trending with national averages as well. But it's interesting. On a divorce case, you have every possible component under the sun, from retirement accounts, businesses, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, debt instruments, you name it, you know, your individuals for the Mountain Money Show, if they have funds and assets and resources, it's going to be something they want to be aware of. The first thing I would tell any individual is, you know, seek competent, good legal counsel if you have a question. The other thing I would tell him is seek it early. A lot of people wait too long, and they get into a situation, they do things that disadvantage themselves to a tremendous degree. It's really wise for them to just get a consultation.
What are some of the things you've seen? Give people examples. What are things that people do that later they realize have disadvantaged them?
Here's a perfect example, even in the Park City area. We have a lot of individuals here who are have second homes. Maybe they live in St. George and they like to ski here or something, so they buy a second home. Well, maybe a family trust provided them, we'll just use a number of $2 million, okay? And then they take that money, they buy a home here in the greater area, and they put their husband's name on it or their wife's name on that. Well, now it becomes joint marital property, where if they wanted to keep it separate, under Utah law, you have to keep those funds separate, or if you purchase an asset, you've got to keep that asset separate by keeping it titled just in your name. If you commingle that, now he or she, whatever the case may be, has a claim on that asset. It's 50% marital. Depending on the value of the asset, you can make a multi-million dollar mistake in one move if that's something that you is an unintended consequence, if you're not aware of that. So we recommend people, anytime they have a question, to, you know, give us a call. We do free consultations over the phone. Happy to answer any questions. You can make, again, multi-million dollar mistakes if you're not careful.
Talk to us a little bit about some of the family law that is particular to Utah.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of interesting components here in Utah. Utah, you start seeing larger families than the national average. So in that situation, you're dealing with custody and visitation. Custody is, you have physical custody, you have legal custody with families. A lot of times we have individuals that work out of state here in Utah. Maybe a spouse is here locally and then the other works out of state or travels frequently. That's an important thing for visitation issues, child support issues. It's a complex situation, a divorce is. So you have joint physical, sole physical, you have legal custody, you have parenting plans that have to be filed, you have alimony components. They all tie together. And it's a complex equation. You need some good legal advice to get that sorted out, if you're even considering it or if you have an issue or question.
Yeah, so Chris, I like your advice about getting advice early on, not waiting, and just make sure you understand the landscape. I'll share some advice as well. I work with high net worth families on the wealth management side. We work with about 500 families, and I don't know, every year, unfortunately, there's one or two families that are going through a divorce. And a couple things I share with them is give each other permission and recognize you're probably going to see the worst of each other through this process. It's a very difficult process. It's not going to be who you are forever, right? There's going to be this period of time, but just realize on both sides, to the extent you can, be willing to forgive behavior that is really, you know, looking back, it'll be inappropriate. Both people will say, gosh, I can't believe that. But you know what? In the vast majority of the times you see that. The other piece that I think is important is that you're not trying to harm the other person through divorce. You know, sometimes we'll have folks that say, you know, Doug, I want a referral to an attorney, and I want somebody that's a shark, or you know, mm-hmm. somebody that's ferocious, and we call it the animal referral. And usually that's not going to serve somebody well. I tell people when they're looking for a divorce attorney, the best thing is you got to have two good attorneys that know how to work together well, or it can get expensive really quickly. How do people do that? How do they select two attorneys that can help with this process?
Excellent question. So the first thing you want to do is go with an attorney that is familiar with this area of the law. The second thing is just like purchasing anything that's important, whether it's a service or an item, you want to talk to somebody and get a feel for them and their personality type and what they do. We tell a lot of clients we can be as mild as you need us to be and try and help them. So we're very anxious and willing to assist people however they need, but happy to help.
Okay. Well, great advice. We thank both of you for coming in. Our guests have been Lauren Forsythe, an attorney at Christopher Greenwood & Associate, and Christopher Greenwood himself from Ogden. Thank you guys for coming in. And Lauren, good luck to you here in Park City.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Stay tuned. You're listening to Mound Money. We're going to talk about the sled dogs and fun camps for the kids this summer. You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW.
This is Matt Mitten, attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, our firm provides estate planning and other personal legal services to residents of Summit County and beyond. We are online at joneswaldo.com and 435-200-0085.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I'm Sarah Barnes here with Doug Wells, and we have with us now Fernando and Dana Ramirez from Luna Lobos Dog Sledding and Rancho Luna Lobos Dog Care and Boarding, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Full disclosure, I have been on a dog sled both in the winter and the summer.
Awesome.
So I know a little
and
bit
I have,
about
it. I've been on neither, but I've seen the sled dogs and they're beautiful.
Thank you.
It's a lot of fun. Now tell us how you got started in this unique industry.
I've been running dogs since I was a kid here in elementary school at in Parley's Park, and so I've kind of grown up with it. And then, let alone, you know, I didn't realize I could make a career out of it, so I kind of lucked out with that.
And are you competitive?
Yes, ma'am, we are. We are running races as well as touring and getting as much exposure to the sport as we can, to the locals and just all the tourists.
Tell us a little bit about the dogs. How many do you have? What breeds are they? I know from your Facebook page you recently had puppies.
We did. Yeah, we have about 30 dogs right now. We have a mix between Alaskan Huskies, we have Siberians, we have a couple of wolf mixes in there. But a lot of our Alaskan Huskies are mixed with a type of working dog, so they're bred to go faster, longer, just better endurance all around. So
Fernando, you've been doing this since you were younger. I suspect that's been 10 plus years. How he's still fairly young, but how have the winters seem like they've gotten more mild in the last couple of years? How has that affected both your hobby and your business?
You know, yes, the winters definitely have gone pretty mild since I can remember. You know, but it does, it affects us quite a bit. Normally, in a decent winter, we can start our sled season around late November, and we used to be able to go to, you know, middle of March, third week of March. But now we find that we're mostly starting to tour first to second week of December and pulling the plug about the last week of February.
For our winter sleds.
For our winter sleds. Yeah. And then we finish out the season through April on our summer carts. So it's kind of a sad thing to see.
So when I went on my winter tour, mm-hmm. I was amazed to discover how quickly the dogs pulled the sled.
Yes.
So on a typical tour, how fast do the sleds get going, and how does that compare to a race situation, a competitive situation?
It's a great question. It depends on the type of racing you're doing. During tours, we like to keep it pretty pedestrian. So we have little kids that, you know, are a little timid at first, and so we usually go about 5 to 6 miles an hour, nice and tranquil. If we're competing in sprint racing, I mean, some of those dogs can go up to 15, 17 miles an hour for 20 miles, which is pretty impressive. But our dogs are more of the ultra marathon runners, you know, very athletic, very slender. They can handle a good 30, 40 miles, about 10 miles an hour. So it's about 6 minute mile pace, which is pretty impressive. I wish I could do that. Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be hosting summer camps with these slender athletic dogs. they're running the show and you guys are helping out. Tell us about the summer camps.
Yeah, so we are going to be running summer camps at our ranch. So we have a few variety of things that will be going on there. We'll, of course, have the dogs doing tours with the summer sled. And we also have an obstacle course that for kids and not the dogs. The dogs are, we usually will do tours with the dogs in the morning for the kids' camp just because it's a little bit cooler. And then we'll teach them all about the sport. They'll get to really hands-on learning what it's like to be out there with the dogs in the kennel and what all the care that goes into it. It's a very, very long process. It's not very quick. Like people think that's the short part. The ride is the easy part. The rest of it that goes on behind the scenes is quite a process. So they'll get to learn all about that and...
So what does a beginner in dog sledding do, and how does that progress over time?
Basically learning the dogs, learning what they can handle, and just, I would say, mostly feeling comfortable with yourself around a team of dogs is the most important one. The dogs will definitely feed off whatever the musher feels, kind of that energy, that aura type, if you want to call it that. And so feeling comfortable and confident with a large number of dogs is a little, confusing at first, I guess. So, but what we want to do is show the kids how fun it can be. We live in such an area that, I used to tie on my yellow lab, harness him, and he'd pull me on skis, a bike, or a makeshift sled, or whatever I could get my hands on.
It's called ski jorning, right?
There's
special gear for that. Going back to the summer camp, what's kind of the age group that you're targeting? And if folks are interested, how do they get a hold of you? And I'm going to ask a third question as well. If at the end of the summer, one or two of the kids are interested in doing this on an ongoing basis, do they have the availability to do that with your group?
Yeah, so we are pretty much open to any age range. We like to kind of start them at about age 8. Obviously, if there's a child that's a little bit more mature for their age, we're open to that.
I'm 52. This sounds like fun. Am I too old or
not
can
at all?
Can have fun as well.
Yeah, we will have any age. We're any age eight and up is welcome, and obviously we'll make allowances if the child is more mature. But yeah, it's open to anybody, any age, and we'll continue on. Even in the winter, if they're interested, we have different programs available. In our winter, we do our junior musher program where they actually get to come out and they learn how to drive the sleds. They can go compete on the different races, so they really get a good hands-on experience. So we're open to that.
We've had some junior mushers flying from all the way from Pennsylvania to come and work with us in the winter, and so that's.
I bet you have. I mean, there's not a lot of places you can do something like this. This sounds like a really interesting summer. And is it something that they sign up for the whole summer? Or can you do it by week? And what's the cost?
It's week by week, and we're going to be starting our camp here in June. Will be the first week that it opens up, and they can sign up for any week, and then it's $200 a child, and we're offering a thing right now that they sign up right before June 1st. We'll give 10% off, and then we also are doing like the birthday parties. That kind of thing is a shorter version of like a summer camp. If somebody wants to come out, they get the teepee experience, the dogs, the obstacle course, and all of that, so that's another option out there.
Another thing we are offering this summer as well is we're starting up our dog boarding. And so and it's kind of sent to be more of a tranquil, mild type of setting. So we're not really having a lot of large number of dogs, but just a lower number where we can have more hands-on. 55-acre ranch we can run around in, so it's kind of more custom to...
Yeah.
Tell us where your ranch is located.
In Browns Canyon. So we're about 15 minutes out of Park City. We're going to be setting up these little cottages. They're about 12 by 16 cottages that we can decorate to look like a house. They have couches and TVs in there, so something more homey for dogs, not your typical.
I thought
boarding.
You were joking, but you're serious. There'll
we're
be couches
serious.
And TVs.
Oh, yeah.
Well, my dog would be all over that. She's not supposed to be on the sofa, but she is all the time.
Yeah, we wanted to keep it something really comfortable and something different to make people feel like their dog is not,
And will your dog come back trained to run the Iditarod?
That's an option, actually. Usually we keep them separate just because we have our pack and then we have the dogs that we're boarding to separately. But people can definitely request for us to train them, and we'll hook them onto the sled and we'll train them. A lot of people do that for ski joring, bike joring purposes, to train their dog to pull, and we're happy to do that for sure.
And tell our audience, how do they get a hold of you? Do you have both a phone number and a website?
Easiest is our website, which is lunalobos.com. And on there, you can book online. It's a pretty user-friendly app or, I guess, site. And or you could call our ranch at 435-783-3473.
And Fernando, am I correct that... part of the purpose of this business is you'd like to go do the Iditarod race, and have you done that yet? And what makes that kind of the premier race for the country?
You know, I've been dreaming about it. I have not done it yet. That's a whole different ball game. The qualifying process is it's pretty intense, and so they want to make sure every team that does go to Alaska, the dogs are as fit as they can be, as healthy as they can be. They've even gone to the extent of drug testing the dogs. So it's a huge, lengthy process, and just to get up there is pretty crazy. But it's definitely a dream of mine, and I hope to get up there someday.
Is there a survival issue with that race? I mean, have there been people that have gotten themselves in bad situations there? Do you have to worry about that as you think about training for this?
You know, definitely. Alaska, it's a whole, like I mentioned before, a whole different world. And with modern technology, they still like to keep it as traditional as they can. So mushers aren't allowed to use any sort of GPS navigation system or two-way communication devices or anything. And so,
do they have a tracker on you? So if you got in trouble, they could find you.
Yes, sir. They do. They do. In fact, sometimes, and there's some sections of the race that get pretty hairy, get huge blizzards or storms, and mushers don't really know where they're going. And so you find them making these, 10, 15 mile circles over and over again because they have no idea where they're at.
What's your time frame for achieving this goal?
You know, to get the dogs fit enough for something like that, it would probably take me at least a couple, 2, maybe 3 years to be able to achieve that goal. And then aside from that is the costs. It costs about, for us here at the Lower 48, it'll cost about $20,000 to $25,000 for the whole gig.
Well, this is fascinating. Unfortunately, we have to wrap. So last question for you. What's kind of your vision for Park City? Should we be a bigger dog sledding community? And are there things that we as a town should be thinking about doing to promote that?
You know, I think Park City is such a great place to be able to run dogs, whether it be competitively or recreationally. It's a great setting. And I think, anyone who's interested to get started, I know we would be more than happy to help anyone out. I know a few other mushers around Utah that would also be on the same boat.
Well, thank you, Fernando and Dina Ramirez from Luna Lobos Dog Sledding. I've enjoyed dog sledding. We've really enjoyed talking to you this morning. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is Brooks, commercial lender for Mountain West Bank. We are proud to support Mountain Money on KPCW, but not responsible for the opinions of Larry or Doug. Our community is unique, and so are Park City businesses. We offer loan solutions to help your business succeed. Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theaters. 649-3369, Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. That was an interesting start to the show. We are looking forward to talking with Iris Bonet. She is a Harvard professor that recently wrote a book about what works, gender equality by design. She's probably a minute or two from joining us on air, and I just want to kind of take the time as a preface for Sarah and I to chat. Sarah, you and I are about the same age.
Yep.
You've gone to where Iris is currently working as a professor. You graduated from Harvard Business School. I don't know about you, but my life experience is there has not been much progress made in gender equality during our professional career, during our professional lifetimes. What's your thoughts on that?
You know, I think with each year, things get better and better. Honestly, when I went to Wall Street after business school in the early 90s, it was a very rough place. And when I left Wall Street, it was a very different place. Not necessarily because of design, as Iris is going to talk about, but because, honestly, they were forced to address some of these issues in awkward but ultimately significant ways. So I'm very interested in talking to her about what her thoughts are.
Good for us. We have the author on the line. I understand I have mispronounced not just your first name, but your second name. It's Iris Bonnet. Iris, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
So just by way of preface and introduction, you are a professor at Harvard University, and you have recently written a book, What Works, Gender Equality by Design. And the by design is the key part. Your focus is not on changing the people, but changing the systems. What do you mean by changing the systems, and why is that important?
That's exactly right. My focus is on making it easier for our biased minds to get things right. And one prototypical example is how orchestras had done it about 20 years ago, or maybe now even longer, where they introduced curtains and had their musicians audition behind curtains. And what they found was that curtains increased the likelihood that women would advance to future rounds by about 50%, to now having about 40% of our female musicians, of our musicians being female. In the 70s, only about 5% of our musicians were women in the 10 major orchestras of the United States. Now it's almost 40%. So the curtain is both a metaphor, but also a real example showing how we can make it easier for biased minds to get things right.
And you mentioned in your book that diversity training with the Fortune 500 and larger companies are currently doing. You mentioned it's an $8 billion a year business. And unfortunately, the evidence points to it's not changing things. Why do you think that is?
That was really disappointing news. I agree with that. We do spend a lot of money on trying to change mindsets. And sadly enough, our minds are pretty stubborn beasts and can't be changed so easily. So, yes, I did go out and try to find every study that I hope every study that has ever tried to evaluate in a rigorous way what difference these diversity trainings actually make. And you're right, the evidence is not encouraging. They either don't do anything, or in some cases, we've even seen some backlash. So, yes, I don't think changing minds is the way to go.
This is Sarah, Iris. I have a question for you. I am a product of a women's college, and I also went to Harvard Business School. And I love the fact that you're using data to address some of these very difficult issues. But how do you overcome some of the skeptics out there and the resistance to, you know, a new way of approaching diversity and that you're suggesting in your book?
So I've actually just visited Silicon Valley, and interestingly enough, the message that I have resonates, at least with the technology community. And I think it resonates for two reasons. One, that community is very data-driven to start with. So saying that we shouldn't just trust our intuitions or our instincts, but let data speak or evidence speak really does resonate. And then the second thing that I hadn't even thought about quite as much, but in retrospect seems completely obvious, many of them are designers. I mean, they are redesigning how we do things. They use technology to do that and make it easier, in that sense, for all of us to do things. And so in that sense, that left me quite hopeful. I should say the other interesting insight that I learned in San Francisco was a very strong belief in meritocracy. And I'm not sure whether this is sometimes the myth of meritocracy or real meritocracy. So that's what we're up against, that in not just in the technology community, but more generally, many firms still think that, you know, for example, unstructured interviews do a good job in predicting future performance when in fact they don't. And that's that myth that that I'm trying to debunk, saying that we can actually improve our processes and really benefit from 100% of the talent pool. This is not just the right thing to do. It's also the smart thing to do.
Well, I'm glad your reception in Silicon Valley was so strong, and I'm glad that that group views themselves as a meritocracy. Unfortunately, the data, if you look at the female positions in technology, it's probably one of the most biased industries in the country, unfortunately, because it's so important. I mean, so many women select out of that industry just because of the cultures that have been created there. Sarah mentioned just before we had you on that she went to Wall Street, and Wall Street used to be famous for being very unfriendly to women. I think actually Wall Street's made some progress, much less so in Silicon Valley. I come from there. I went to business school at Stanford in the Bay Area. A lot of my friends are in technology, but I would tell them, as I'm sharing with you on air, they still have a long ways to go. One of the leaders, one of the icons in that industry is Sheryl Sandberg. You mentioned her in your book, you and Sheryl have some advice for women in technology and women in leadership in general. For instance, when you're negotiating, something as simple as using the word we versus I. Why is that important, and are there other nuggets that you picked up from Sheryl Sandberg?
Well, there's another interesting study that actually also takes place in Silicon Valley. We sometimes call it the Heidi Howard problem, which is actually an answer to your question. So I am getting to an answer to your question, but I think it's an interesting one for our listeners to hear, where a case study was written about a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley.
Heidi Rosen.
And her name is Heidi Rosen. And a number of years later, that case study was changed ever so slightly, namely what the faculty did was replacing her name with Howard. And so half of the students would get the same case study describing what Heidi did, but only that her name was changed to Howard, and the other half of the class would get the original study with the name being Heidi. And what they found was that Heidi and Howard are both perceived as competent, as doing a good job, but people don't like Heidi. And that's really the answer to your question, why it is harder for women to negotiate, because women run into this competence likability dilemma that only women but not men experience, where when women are competent or assertive in negotiations, they violate gender norms and they are punished for violating these norms. That's why Sheryl suggests to use more inclusive language, which tries to bridge this interesting gap between likability and competence, where women can live up to the gender norms of what, in quotation marks, a good woman looks like and behaves like, and also be assertive and competent. And yes, there are a number of tricks. I mean, another one, which is actually quite important to know about, is that women do experience this dilemma when negotiating, but only when negotiating on behalf of themselves. Now, of course, in many negotiations, if not in most, women negotiate on behalf of somebody else. It could be their families, could be their kids, could be their clients, could be their organizations. And that's when it's actually okay for women to be both assertive and they're still perceived as being likable, because they fulfill gender norms in doing the best they can for the people they care for, and therefore they can be assertive with the other person at the negotiating table.
So where do you start? Do you start with the educational system? Do you, as you suggest, start designing diversity mm-hmm. within professional organizations? Do you start with the evaluation processes that we go through either at the educational level or in the professional arena? Where do you start? It seems like a chicken and the egg question.
Well, you know, honestly, I think we have to do all of those. So I don't have a very easy answer, but clearly we have to do all of those. And we are doing all of those. So we have to, start in the educational system. We have to make it easier for girls and boys to, for example, study counter-stereotypical subjects. So, for example, male teachers in elementary school, in particular, in subjects that we don't normally associate with men, such as reading and writing, is absolutely crucial for boys. And it's equally as crucial to have more female leaders and teachers in STEM, in science, technology, economics, math, engineering, all those kinds of subjects. So yes, so we have to start in school, and there are some, you know, encouraging design examples which have leveled the playing field relatively early on in people's careers. So one of, I think, the happiest stories in my book is the redesign of the SAT, which now also is gender biased. I mean, lots of things have changed in probably the most important test that an American student ever has to take, but also it has been gender biased. And just very quickly, how this was done was by a former student of mine, a doctoral student of mine, Katie Baldiga-Kaufman. She was concerned that particularly the multiple choice part of the SAT might lead to gender bias. Why? Because when people didn't know the right answer, they were instructed to guess, to just volunteer an answer. Now, it turns out that if we have different levels of willingness to take risk in our society, those more willing to take risk will be more willing to guess. Guessing, after all, is risky. And those more averse to risk will be more likely to skip a question. And what she found was controlling for ability, for what people would have known, she in fact finds a gender gap in willingness to guess, with women skipping more and men guessing more. And that cost women points on the SAT, even though they would have known exactly the same as their male colleagues. That has been changed now by taking the penalties away from wrong answers completely, which of course then led to the criticism that now guessing was encouraged even more, at which point the answer has to be that we have been inviting guessing by 50% of the population for a long time, and now we've enabled everyone to guess.
What I love about the examples and the suggestions you give in your book is they're relatively simple to exercise and to implement. We've had other guests talk about gender equality. It's an important issue to me personally. I think the radio station here in Park City has done a good job of keeping this issue on the forefront. Oftentimes people will talk about the funnel issue. Sarah was asking about, you know, how to eliminate some of these biases. Let's talk about the funnel. You gave a talk, I believe it was to Google, where you talked both about the interviewing process, but then also how organizations get the right people to apply. You used the example of Diet Coke and Coke Zero. Could you talk about both those issues, please?
Yes, sure. In fact, this is a great example for super low-hanging fruit that we collectively, we as a world, have actually spent quite a bit of time and money and energy in understanding how we could market our product. And that's why I talked about Coke and Pepsi and other soft drink companies, which have actually tried to understand what kind of language resonates with which segment of their customer group, including men and women. We should do the very same thing for our job advertisements. In fact, researchers have analyzed the adjectives that we use in our job advertisements and can show that holding the gendered nature of the job constant, meaning whether we're looking whether we're looking for an engineer or for a nurse, let's say, which both are, of course, gendered jobs associated with men or women respectively. So holding that constant, they can show that if you use adjectives such as competitive, leadership, assertive, you'll be more likely to attract men. And if you use adjectives such as cooperative, inclusive, supportive, compassionate, then you're more likely to attract women. And so that's really easy to fix for companies to use gender-inclusive language to make sure that the applicant pool is really representative of society and they can benefit from 100% of the talent pool.
I certainly acknowledge that there are many enlightened organizations out there, but I'm skeptical that that we can introduce this sea change in, you know, developing new norms within a generation. How long do you think this will take for us to understand and eliminate some of these unconscious and, frankly, conscious biases in both the educational system and the, you know, professional community?
Yeah. So it's an excellent question. I mean, we do have some evidence for that. It actually comes out of India. Unbeknownst to most people, India was one of the first countries to introduce quotas for local politics. And this is actually not a quota per se example, but what quotas do, of course, is that they change numbers very quickly. And an important argument in my book is that seeing really is believing, or to believe you need to see. And so what the amendment did was it mandated that a third of all village heads had to be female. And researchers were now able to examine what difference makes and when do these norms start to change. And it turns out that the first female leader didn't have a huge impact, even though she already provided more public goods than her male counterparts. But she didn't think she was very effective, nor did the village think that she was very effective. It was the second woman. And so in villages which have been exposed to at least two female leaders in those about more than 20 years now, in those villages, mindsets have started to change, and people are starting to associate political leadership with women. In fact, a recent science paper examining this can show that now one of the core career aspirations of parents is for their daughters to become politicians. So that's, less than a generation. That's about 20 years or, two sequences of female leaders in political office. But there's a number of lessons from this. One is you actually have to see it. You can't just preach it, or you can't just theorize about things. And that's, I think, why diversity trainings are such a difficult instrument for us. So you have to see it. You have to experience it. And it does take a little bit of time, but you're not that long.
So seeing is believing. You mentioned that India has put some systemic pieces in place to create that gender diversity so that people do see it. The U.S. has a real problem in fostering getting women into leadership roles, particularly in business. The S&P 500, you had a graph on a talk that you gave at Google that showed the number of women that are on boards at S&P 500 companies. If I'm correct in my little bit of background research on you, you're a board member of Credit Suisse Group. What have you learned being on the board of Credit Suisse as a woman, and what advice do you have for business leaders in getting women into senior leadership positions and boards?
So, of course, I'm primarily a researcher, and a sample size of one, which is my own experience, always gives me concerns. But let me tell you a bit about my experience, but then maybe give you a bit of research on that very question as well. And that is, I've actually worked with the UK government and help them increase gender diversity on the UK boards. The FTSE 100 boards are the biggest 100 companies in the UK, and the United Kingdom decided not to introduce quotas. And that's why I think it's actually important for our listeners to know about this, because I think it's much more likely that the US, if it adopts any approach, it will adopt this approach. So what the UK did was it built a coalition between private sector leaders, so enlightened private sector leaders, that weren't that many initially, but a handful, the public sector. It was then the UK Secretary of Business, Cable, Vince Cable was his name, and kind of some NGOs, in particular the 30% Club. And they set a goal for themselves, namely 25% women on corporate boards on the FTSE 100 companies by the end of last year, by 2015, which they have reached, are now 26%. But they didn't only set a goal. Then they used lots of these design principles that I discuss in my book to move the needle, to kind of help nudge companies to move in that direction. And things that they did included, for example, something that is called comply or explain, where companies have to set sub-goals for themselves. And if they haven't reached them at the end of every year, they have to explain why not. So the default becomes, 17%, 19%, 22%. So it increased every year. So that's the default assumption. And if you didn't reach it, you had to explain why not. And those explanations, some of them were really deep, as in, here's where we advertised, here's where we looked, here's the search company we worked with, here's the number of men and women we interviewed. Here's why, in the end, for example, we really, really needed an engineer and we couldn't find a woman or something like that. But there are alternative approaches. That's why I'm sharing the example here. There are alternative approaches two quotas, which are much more based on design, which have been proven to work, which makes me hopeful for the U.S. as well. But, you know, my own experience, I think it's very helpful that there are three of us and that I'm not the only one. And so numbers do matter. This is not a new insight. That's a pretty old insight. The idea that critical mass is important, and ideally you want to have 30%, roughly 30% of any minority, whether these are women or men or certain nationalities or or races. So 30% or three of a kind. Because when you only have one, what often happens is that we reduce that person's expertise to the demographic group that he or she belongs to. So then I will be asked questions about, so how do women feel about this, or how do economists feel about this, or things of that sort, which you don't want to see happen. And I think that's something that I definitely see on the board that I'm serving, that we are there for our expertise, and while we do talk about gender questions as well, I'm very happy to talk about it because it is part of my expertise, but I also talk about other questions that where a behavioral economist can add value, such as culture or compliance or trust or things of that sort.
And does the 30%, you know, women on a board, does that help others overcome the conditionally cooperative mindset that you have coined in your book?
So the research on gender diversity in corporate boards, as you might imagine, is young because we don't have that many women on corporate boards. But we certainly do find, I have to be very careful here, some weak evidence that there is a positive relationship between gender diversity and company performance. And I'm so careful here because we, meaning collectively again, have done many, many different studies, and the devil seems to be a bit in the details. So, for example, it also matters how diversity came to be. So when you go to Norway, Norway is another country which introduced quotas, you go to Norway and look at the impact of quotas on boards, then we have to acknowledge that the short-term impact was negative. So in Norway, what companies had to do is the following. They had to increase the fraction of women on their corporate boards to 40% between 2003 and 2006. And then what you find in the data is that it had short-term negative impact on the financial performance of these companies. Now, there's two potential mechanisms which might both have played a role. We don't quite know which one it was, or maybe there's others. But one is that new teams rarely do better than old teams, because newness means you have to get to know each other until you function again. You know, it takes a moment. So, for example, when you fly in a plane, you should hope as a passenger that your airline crew has known each other for a while. There's actually really interesting research on that very question.
And that sounds like newness. That sounds like great advice. Iris, unfortunately, there's so many more questions both Sarah and I have. I wish we had time to ask. I'll put in a plug for your book. You have some very good insights on what we should be doing differently on interviewing. It's something that we all do. And you make a very strong case why we should completely eliminate unstructured conversational interviews. People will have to pick up a copy of your book to find the answer to that. Our guest this morning has been Iris Bonet. Her book is What Works, Gender Equality by Design. Iris, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, I apologize that we had to wrap up that conversation. It's a very important topic. We appreciate Iris joining us. We also thank our other guests, Lauren Forsythe, Fernando, and Dana Ramirez, and once again, Iris Bonet, the author of What Works. We also want to thank our great sponsors, Mountain West Bank, Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Designs, Jones Waldo, Holbrook and McDonough, and All Resorts Group and Park City. I also want to thank my great co-host today, Sarah Barnes. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
So as Sarah mentioned, she's got quite, or as I mentioned in the open, Sarah has quite the esteemed background as well. She mentioned she went to Harvard Business School. She was on Wall Street, did M&A for Citigroup, locally worked here for Leucadia as well as Zane Benefits. It was a great show this morning. We thank you all for joining us. The weather this week is looking to be quite nice for the coming days, and unfortunately a little bit rain in the forecast. Sarah, thank you once more for coming in. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. NPR News is next. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to welcoming back Larry Warren next week.